Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 29th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Muslims in the USA. Our presenter is Nellie Van Dorn Harder. Session number VAN 2006-4. Let's listen in.
Well, good evening, everybody. I'm not sure if I know everybody by now or if everybody knows me by now, so maybe I should introduce myself one more time. My name is Nellie Van Dorn Harder. I teach at Valparaiso University, and before that, I was for 10 years a missionary. I first was in Egypt, where I set up a refugee agency. And then I went to Indonesia, and when I worked in Egypt, I worked for the Dutch church, because I'm from the Netherlands. And I never planned to come here, for your information. I'm not trying to skip the border. But I met an American and got married, and all of you now know, right, who are unmarried. It's dangerous to be in Egypt unmarried, right? I warned some of you. Who did not know about this warning yet? Who doesn't know about it yet? Because lots of people who I know come unmarried to Egypt, find their partner there. And it's always never someone from the same country. But that's, I mentioned that already. Anyway. After that, my husband and I worked for the Division for Global Mission of the LCA in Indonesia. We were both teachers in what you would call a seminary here. So. And then in 1999 I came to Valparaiso University, and where I teach world religions and Islamic studies. And for tonight, the topic is Islamic communities in the United States. Now, my question to you is: has anybody any idea how many Muslims we have in the States? Do we have any idea how many Lutherans there are? What? 3 million? What? 11 million?
6 million.
That's what I always hear. 5 or 6 million. I don't know.
It's 11,000 congregations.
11,000 congregations. Okay, well, it seems that there right now are around the same number of Muslims as there are Lutherans. And as there are Presbyterians in the United States. I don't know, I haven't counted that. It's very hard to count. Very hard to count. Because, of course, remember, who was there yesterday when we talked about Islam in Europe? Remember what we were constantly coming back to, how diverse all these communities were. And that, you know, that the people try to unify them, but they come from all kinds of countries, from all kinds of backgrounds. And you just cannot say it's one. It's like, Catholics, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Lutherans, Presbyterians, moving to the States, and then we're suddenly all Christians, but we would never accept the same pastors and the same liturgy, and so forth and so forth. Now, does anybody have a clue, unless you know it, I don't think you never guessed it, I never guessed it, where the first community was of Muslims in the United States? Where are they?
Pennsylvania.
Iowa. Iowa. Where?
Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Iowa. That was the first mosque.
That was the first mosque.
That was the first mosque. The first substantial community was in Ross, North Dakota. And I don't know where that is. I know where North Dakota is. Ross, North Dakota. Sorry. My lack of geography. And so what we are looking at, really, that's why I thought we should talk about this, because we are looking at a changing religious landscape, and who of us feels we're prepared for it? Well, we're not really prepared for that. We are actually in the same situation as the Europeans. Suddenly, we notice a change, we recognize things are different, but none of us is really prepared for it. We haven't really thought about this, and we don't know what to do with it. And for your information, it's the same for the Muslims. They are not prepared for being here either, right? Because remember we talked yesterday about Europe. Most of the people came as immigrant workers, as guest workers. Then we had a lot of refugees. And here we have different groups. People came in waves, and actually, the first people from the Middle East were mostly Christians, like from Lebanon and from the what used to be the Ottoman Empire. Those were mostly Christians that who were fleeing the Middle East and the Muslim communities and who have settled here. But then we had, you know, we have the Iranian Revolution. We talked about that yesterday too. We have Afghanistan. We had the war with Russia. We have Iraq already before the war. Now we had, of course, Saddam Hussein. From the whole Middle East, we have people who came as immigrants or as refugees or who came as students and stayed. A lot of them came as students and stayed. But the big difference between the European communities and the U.S. communities is educational level. The educational level of the Muslims in the States is most of the time much higher than the Muslims, that of the Muslims in Europe. Now, let me stop 1 second. Can everybody hear me? Do I sound loud enough? Okay. So there's a big difference there. And that means, what does it mean? That these people are further ahead, so to speak. It means that you have more developed communities, and that also the questions they ask, the rituals that they have set up, the organizations, and so forth, are way more developed than what you find in Europe. However, and this is what's interesting, the issues are very much the same. The problems are the same. It's very strange, and I'll come back to that. But let me just ask you, what have you heard recently, let's say the last 2-3 years, from Muslims in the States? Was there anything you heard that really rippled the waters or was on the front page of the newspaper? Not much, right?
No.
After 9/11 and everything after that, there's not very much. Well, I heard something, but it might not have struck you, but when I mention it, you might recognize it, that really sent shockwaves through the whole world, through the whole Muslim world. That was when a woman called Amina Wadud gave a sermon in the Friday service in New York to both men and women. Have we? Who heard about that? I see people not now. Now, why was that so terrible? She's a woman. What?
And normally men and women don't worship. Yeah, they don't worship together, and they're not together in a community like that.
Well, they can worship together, but they have to sit separate. It's depending on the mosques. A woman is never allowed to preach the ritual sermon on Friday. That can only be done by a man, because you have to be ritually clean, and as we all know, sometimes women are ritually unclean. Do we all know that?
Yeah.
Do we know what makes them unclean?
Yeah.
Okay, I will have to explain. Now, you know, assuming that women might lie about their state of being, no woman can ever do this. Now, what do you think, what does that mean, that Amina Wadud? Who knows Amina Wadud? Shall I write her name down?
Yeah. Yes.
Amina Wadud Mohsen, but I think she divorced because she's cut the Mohsen off lately. Amina Wadud, who knows her?
No. She's a psychologist, right?
She's, I think she was. She became a scholar of Islam now. Yeah. Does anybody know where she comes from? Who her father was? A Methodist preacher.
Oh.
A Methodist preacher. She is American. She is African-American. And her father was a Methodist preacher. And I heard her once preach in the Netherlands, or I heard her give a lecture in the Netherlands, and it was like a Baptist sermon. The way she preached, and all the Dutch were like, what's this? That's another question. That's another issue. But Amina Wadud, she, first of all, is African-American, and we know that 40% of the Muslim community is African-American. They are indigenous. They're from here. And they come, where do they come from? Does anybody know which group, which movement they come from? Have you heard of the Nation of Islam?
Yeah.
The Nation of Islam. That's where the African-American Muslim movement started. And do we all know what the Nation of Islam is?
Mm-hmm.
We know what it is? Who says, I know a little? Yeah? What is it?
Well, I guess it was a movement that started in the 30s, I think, and the most famous person associated with Malcolm.
Malcolm X, right?
And it was a movement that started in Detroit, in the Michigan mm-hmm. area, and has spread to other communities. And then there was a major split between
right.
the group that associated with Malcolm and the group associated with Prophet Elijah.
Right.
And now that's Louis Farrakhan is from that tradition. And the other tradition, who's the, Malcolm's daughter or his granddaughter?
Imam Muhammad, who is Muhammad, who is Elijah's son.
Yeah.
Imam Muhammad. I'll write down for you a little bit so that you can visualize it. Anyway, the first real Muslim group that came about in the United States, that was more than a handful, was local. It were Muslims that later on gathered under the name of Nation of Islam, and actually it was black supremacy. It was, the idea was, we were slaves, our forefathers were Muslims, and we are going back to the Muslim faith. And there was a man, he was called Muhammad Farq, and he somehow found parts of the Quran, and he started to read that. And from that reading, I don't know how he did it, he somehow decided that the Quran teaches that the white people are far inferior to the black people.
Yeah.
You know about that, right? Who didn't know that? Who didn't know? Okay. So that is how it started. It started as an empowerment movement of people of color in the United States. And then it comes in people like Malcolm X, who go to Mecca and say, wait, you're actually doing some things wrong here. And people who start to study Islam and realize what we are doing is not the correct way of interpreting Islam. And that's why we now have two groups. We still have the group of Louis Farrakhan that has its headquarters in Chicago. And we have the group of Imam W.D. Muhammad. So that is a large group and a very interesting group of Muslims. So in a way, we have to always keep that in mind, because they are very different from the people coming from Iran, Pakistan, Egypt, and so forth and so forth. I don't have to go further, right? They are very different. Their cult in culture and in ways of thinking, they're very, very different. And you know how you see the difference. Every year in September, there is in Chicago a huge congress of ISNA, and you have to know ISNA. ISNA is the Islamic Society of North America. And that is, has any of you ever heard of ISNA? The Islamic Society of North America. They meet every September in Chicago. I forgot which week, I think it's the third one. And the Nation of Islam, in the same weekend, has its own meeting, and they absolutely refuse to meet together. They do not want to meet with ISNA, because they say those people are so Middle Eastern, so strict Islamic, so not adapted to America. We don't want to mix with that. And actually, it's much more fun to go to this group. Much more fun. Because they have like a fair. You can buy really cool, you know, printed batiks and dresses. And they have music. And they have these sermons that indeed sound like a Baptist church, you know, and all swept up and say, oh, why am I? I'm not a Muslim. I couldn't know. This is wonderful. And but what really divides these people from the other Muslims is that most of these people have lots of members of the family who are not Muslim, who are Christian. And so they are used to mixing with non-Muslims, and they are used to, you know, thinking about where is my position vis-a-vis Christianity. Because someone like Amina Badu, do you know how she became a Muslim? And lots of people of her generation, I gather she's about 60 now, lots of people of her generation became Muslim in the time of the Black Panthers. And so again, it was an empowerment movement. In the time anti-apartheid, but you didn't call it that here. Civil rights movement, thank you. They felt that Islam could offer them much more than Christianity. However, what they told me is they weren't Muslim. They had no idea what Islam meant. They just were Muslim. without ever reading the Quran, ever praying. They had no idea what it was. What they did, you know, they were just gathering as a social action group, more or less, an anti-discrimination group, civil rights group. And only later, let's say 20 years down the line, they started to study Islam. And then, whoa, the problem started. Because someone like Amina Wadud decided, I'm going to study Islam, and I'm going to write a PhD, and I'm about women in the Quran. And then she saw what was about women in the Quran and said, oh, wait a minute, I'm going to write a PhD about how women can read the Quran. And she made a book that was an interpretation by a woman about how they can read the Quran. Now, can you think of people who absolutely did not like that? Do I need to say more? I mean, all the imams and sheikhs in the Middle East were on their head. And, you know, they just, you know, what is this? The book is in English. This woman is a woman, you know, and. And so that was her first step. But, you know, she came from this social activism. She's in battle. And so then the next thing was when things calmed down and Amina Wadud was kind of, you know, in easy waters, somehow she needed some more action. And she decided, I'm going to give the Friday sermon. And then, you know, from all over the Muslim world, she was condemned for that. And, you know, people said, oh gosh, will you be shot for it? And they said, oh no, they won't recognize me, they won't find me, they won't shoot me. But what it also tells is this, that we are looking at a group of Muslims. And, okay, there's now Amina Wadud, right? But she is slowly linking up. People like her are slowly linking up the very progressive Muslims from all over the world. And so let me write here progressive, okay? These people are linking up. And these people are changing the face of Islam, and as I say, causing lots of imams and ayatollahs near heart attacks. Because what they are doing is so unconventional. And of course, what does it go back to? They all have become individualistic Americans. Right? Isn't that the great thing in America? You can do what you want when you want it, as long as you are inside the law. And that's what she did. And so the shock was not just the woman preaching. The shock was, wait a minute, there is this American, this group of Muslims in America, and we can't say they're not Muslims, and look what they can do if they want to. So you see, we're looking at something very interesting here in the United States, yeah?
Why can't they say they're not Muslims?
Because she is not breaking any Muslim rule. She is veiled. And the only
she follows the law.
And she quoted... Well, a good question. You all know that Muslims base their interpretation on the Quran and the Hadith. And the Hadith is the tradition. You know that? Everybody knows that? The Quran, we know what that is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. According to Muslims, that is the direct word of God. The tradition is everything the Prophet Muhammad said and did and possibly thought, and his closest companions, what they, you know, how they ruled the community, what they did, that is all in the tradition. Well, Amina Wadud, and with her several others, found traditions where the Prophet Muhammad must have said that a woman can preach. He never said, no, women and men together. He didn't say Friday or not Friday. He said, a woman can preach. Right. And it is all a matter of interpretation. So they cannot go against that. She could show them a tradition and said, this is how I interpret this tradition, whatever you think it should be. I don't care, because I'm a scholar like you. That is a nice thing. You know, Islam doesn't have a hierarchy, remember? We were talking about that yesterday. There's no hierarchy. There's no pope. So if you are considered a scholar by a group of Muslims, then you are a scholar. Finished. This, you know, this is how the Nation of Islam started. This man, this Muhammad Fadl, was considered a scholar. And so people followed him. And nobody can stop you. That's how it works in Islam. So what we are looking at is is something very interesting. And before we go on, so we have here what we saw yesterday too, Sunnites and Shiites. Remember?
Yeah.
That difference too, and those two. Oh, hell will freeze over before those two really meet. That is that they have different. They're different organizations. They're different leaders and different mosques and different. They cannot. And the Shiites are mostly refugees from the Iranian Revolution, right? From the time of Khomeini, or they came here to study and never went back. So that's what we have. Now, so apart from this group, so you see you have a lot of African-American converts to Islam, and you have a lot of people coming from Muslim countries. You also have a lot of converts locally, Americans who have converted to Islam for many reasons. Often it's because of marriage, but you have quite a few of them nowadays who also have then studied Muslim studies. You know, Islamic studies. So they are joining the rank of these specialists. And they are also interpreting the text. And they are also saying, I don't accept this any longer. And for example, I give you an example of what they don't want to accept any longer. The other day, some Muslims staged a small revolution because they were so sick of the fact that if you, for example, this is the mosque, okay? Well, this is the entrance for the man, and in the back is the entrance for the women. And then the women have to disappear and make themselves invisible. That is what happens in a lot of mosques. And I said, I'm sorry, either my wife comes with me through that one entrance, or I'm no longer coming to this mosque. And then lots of other men stood up and did the same. So that is something that we are now seeing happening where people are starting to make up their minds of, why do you suddenly apply these rules while in Egypt men and women can go through the same entrance, and while in the States it all of a sudden have to be two entrances? You see? So what does that show us? What do you think that shows us? That in you talk about Iran. I don't know Iran. I've never been there. I'll tell you where I have been and I've seen it. Turkey, Egypt, and Indonesia. I've seen men and women go into the same door. So now we have here the mosques where you suddenly need two doors. Okay? What does that show us? What?
They aren't united. Their traditions are going.
They aren't united.
Some of their traditions are being taken.
They have become hyper-traditional. Mm-hmm. They become hyper... They start to invent traditions that they didn't even have in their own country, right, to be super correct Muslims here. So you see, you have these progressive Muslims, the African-American Muslims, you have these Muslims from Muslim countries, and you have these American U.S. converts who then say, I want to go to one door and not through one, it's through two doors. So this is making, I mean, if you were a Muslim leader somewhere in the Middle East, would you be dizzy by now? If you think about thinking about the community that is growing here? And so what we are seeing is this diversity, and we are seeing what I call this hyper-identity. If I say hyper, you understand what I say? Hyper-identity, that's what we're seeing. And remember yesterday, those of us who were there yesterday, that in Europe, we had the Muslim Brothers, who were very active in straightening out the whole community, in getting everybody on the same line, and everybody following the same rules. How did we call it again, Deanne?
Well, Calvinist Muslims.
Calvinist Muslims, right. Right. So that's what we, you know, everybody had to do the same. All just get rid of all the culture, get rid of all your local habits and all local customs. You can keep the local food, that's fine. But the rest, cut it out and just become, let's say, pure Muslims. Very pure Muslim, whatever that is, of course, right? Now, and so what we see here is that also in the States, these Muslim Brothers, and do we all know what the Muslim Brothers are? Who has never heard of the Muslim Brothers?
Well, we talked about it yesterday.
Yeah, we talked about it yesterday, but some of us were not there, maybe. The Muslim Brothers is a group that was set up in Egypt in the 1920s by a school teacher Hassan al-Banna. And he felt that Muslims were the underdog, and the goal was to strengthen Muslim communities, to give Muslims facilities such as hospitals, clinics, schools, and to Islamize society, to make society Islamic. Yeah? And that was fine in Egypt, because in a way, what they were up against was the colonial powers, with the Western powers, right? So there was a lot of poverty, and there still is a lot of poverty among Muslims, and their goal was to alleviate the poverty. Now, the thing is, there's one problem, and I have to take a side road now. Who has ever heard of a man called Said Qutb? Said Qutb. Who has ever heard of this man? You have, of course. You took classes. Who was Said Qutb? Elsa.
He's an Islamist ethicist, and he's fairly conservative.
He's the philosopher of the Muslim Brotherhood, because the Muslim Brotherhood started out like a salvation army for the Muslims, but then they needed someone who gave them a frame of thinking, a philosophy, and that was Said Qutb. And where did he get his main inspiration? I hate to tell you this. Here in the U.S. How did he get it? Does anybody know? Said Qutb was sent to the U.S. He was a civil servant in the government. The Egyptian government sent him here to learn, you know, about educational methods. And some Christians invited him to their church. And what he saw there has changed the course of history. What did Said Qutb see in the church? In the basement, like this basement. He saw men and women dancing. And the pastor dimmed the lights. Yes, and as he stepped out of that event, he thought, this society is at the verge of destruction. Men and women, unmarried, dancing together. This is the beginning of the end. And then he went back to Egypt and he pondered deeply, thinking, wait a minute, all these Westerners with their ideas are influencing us here in Egypt. You know, their ideas about education, but also they bring radios, TVs, cars. This is scary, because if they are on the verge of destruction, what's going to happen to us if we take their ideas into our society? And he then came up with the philosophy that you should make a very sharp distinction. You should draw a line in society for true Muslims and the rest. Between true Muslims and the rest. And the true Muslims were all Muslims who did what he thought Muslims should do. So, among the rest are most Muslims of the world. You know, don't forget that. Most Muslims don't do what Said Qutb think Muslims should do. He was it was like setting up a monastery for Muslims. That's what he wanted to do. You know, Muslims grouping together and being extremely devout and extremely focused on their Muslim knowledge, Muslim behavior, Muslim this, Muslim that, although nobody knows what that is, right? So that is what we see with Said Qutb. And Said Qutb is in a direct line to Bin Laden. By the way, because the rest can be seen as ungodly, as pagan, as heathen, and once you've made this division, you can kill the rest. You see? And that is not in the Quran. This is not based on the Quran. In the Quran it says that you have to respect others, and that you have to respect Christians, and you have to respect Jews. And remember yesterday we were talking about that if God would have wanted, he could have created one religion, but he didn't do it. Right? So this is a new interpretation of Said Qutb to divide the world. And so these Muslim brothers, they followed these ideas, and for some of them it became a bit too much. They said, well, if it means killing others, I'm not in. You know, I don't want to do that. But this mindset came to the States as the Muslim Student Association, MSA, Muslim Student Association. Those are from the Muslim Brothers, and they are from the time after Said Qutb. Said Qutb was executed in the 50s. I forgot the exact year, 57, 58, because he tried to kill Nasser, President Nasser. For those of you who weren't born after 1960, maybe you remember Nasser, President Nasser. Yeah. Said Qutb was executed because he was a big threat to the regime, because of course President Nasser was among the rest, right? And all his ministers were among the rest, so he could kill them. Well, so the Muslim Student Association, that is the one who came to the States, because unlike in Europe, here most Muslims were students or professionals, and they started to, you know, to lobby among Muslims to become one group. And then out of this Muslim Student Association, the Islamic Society of North America came about. You see, so the mindset of the biggest organization, because these two became the biggest, is puristic Islam, trying to unite everybody. And of course this doesn't work. You know, you can try, but of course it doesn't work, because you still have the Amina Wadoots and the progressive Muslims and the Nation of Islam and the African-American Muslims. You have all kinds of other Muslims still going around. But if you say what is happening in the States, in the Muslim universe, then we have to see that these are the ones you see mostly on TV. And if you ask, for example, you will ask for an advice, then they will give the answer. They are the ones who will give the answer. Now, do we all know what an advice is called in Islam, in Arabic, the fatwa? Have we all heard about the fatwa? Mm-hmm. Who has not heard about the fatwa? Yeah. It sounds a bit like an exotic dish, right? But it isn't. It's a fatwa. It's an advice, legal advice. And so, can we follow me? Who cannot follow me? Who has a question right now?
I have a question, but it's not about following.
Okay.
So, one of the things that I think as Americans we've always wondered, of all stripes, is how could our government be so absolutely clueless about the dynamics, cultural, political, and so forth, that exist both in our country and the world in relation to Islam? Here you are, somebody who is at Holden Village talking to us about this.
Yeah.
And it seems like, you know, 99% of the State Department doesn't have a clue about any of this stuff, because the policies they formulate clearly don't reflect any of this kind of understanding. No. What? I mean, the government must know you exist.
Well,
I'm just trying to get, even if we assume, the current administration is clueless in a lot of ways. There are people in Congress, there's others.
Yeah.
I mean, are you ever consulted on policy?
Well, look, there are lots of people who are extremely well informed.
Right.
Lots and lots and lots. And that used to be my big question. Yeah. How can it be that so many people are well informed? Ingrid, there is a chair for you.
No.
If you want, are you sure? Okay. But how can it be that so many people are so well informed and yet we're going all these other directions? The only answer I have, and here, I'm not American, remember? I don't understand politics here, and probably I'm not the only one who doesn't understand. There is policy and there's reality. And the policy has primacy over reality. That's what I think that is happening here. Because they know inside out at the State Department. They know exactly what happens at the Muslim Student Association. They know exactly what happens at Islam. And then, of course, the state of the ones who know don't always contact the ones who don't know. Because remember, after 9/11, there was this imam from California praying with Bush, and then or in the White House, and then it was found out that he had close ties to Hamas. Do you remember that? You see? So there's always people in the middle who don't quite know and just phone someone, and you know, then it happens. So, but you see, the fact, we hear all this news about people paying money to Hamas, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And so because that is normal. You know, in the mindset of these people, that is normal. You have to assist Hamas. You have to assist the people who struggle against Israel. That to them, there is really nothing strange about that. So that is... But, you know, would Amin Mahdoud assist Hamas? No. Would the progressives assist Hamas? No. Why not? Because they think differently. What's the difference in thinking? This group thinks legally. They, when you ask them a question, they go and see in the Quran, in the tradition, in the whole body of interpretations, or you might hope they look at the whole body. They often look only at the interpretations they like. You know, they in what they like in the interpretations, and they will give you an answer based on those writings of Muslims before them and Muslims now. When you ask this group, should I assist Hamas, they will say, wait a minute, there's things like human rights. Yes, there is social justice, but if you, in the name of social justice, murder other people, there's something wrong with your social justice. You see? So that is how there's this difference in thinking, legal thinking, and that is something we always have to remember. That I think the big split that is going on between the Muslim communities now is that one wants to hang on to legal thinking, and some of those become hyper-Muslims, and others say, no, you have to place it in society. You have to place it totally all in context only, and my context is human rights. It's you know, civil rights. It's not just the law. You see? And if they use the law, they will interpret the law differently because that is their frame of mind. Yeah? Can we follow all that?
Yeah.
Are there any questions right now? Or anything you want to say or say now? The light bulb went on. Now I understand what I read in the newspaper. Yeah?
I just wondering, because I work with the Muslim Student Association on campus. Well, not so much directly, but I see them on campus. How monolithic is MSA, or is there a lot of differences?
No, they're no longer monolithic, because they have now a lot of students. They've become like a clearinghouse for lots of students from different countries. And then if you, out of them, ISNA came about, and they are not monolithic either, and they have moved to the middle. And that's where, Jody, you told us about the meal you had. That was it organized by ISNA?
They were part of it.
They were part of it. They have realized that, you know, you cannot keep dividing the world in Muslim, non-Muslim. We live in the United States of America, especially after 9/11. You know, we better lighten up and better see how we fit into this society. Because otherwise, the ones who will suffer are the Muslims themselves. Yeah? Other questions? Yeah, I see two there.
You've emphasized a literal conservative element and a more modern element of this song, but I've heard there's 157 different sects. Is that approximately correct?
It's probably more. There's probably more sects.
In the United States.
Within Islam.
Within Islam.
Oh, yeah. Because I only mentioned a few. You have the mystics, the Sufis. Then you have all kinds of... subdivisions from each country, and you know, it's very much like denominations. People will not be seen dead in one church, or not being seen dead in one mosque. You see, that is the same, but it's all called Islam. It's not called Presbyterian, Lutheran, Anglican.
Mm-hmm.
It's all Islam, but there are huge differences among those groups. So I think there are more than 157. Yeah, and then also, what becomes American Muslims, like third, fourth generation, and they are starting to apply Islamic teachings here, there's going to be huge diversity of what is possible, what is not possible. You know, the biggest discussion, I saw you raised your hand, Diane, I saw you, but what was the biggest discussion on the internet among Muslims the last 2-3 years? What do you think?
Role of women?
Yeah. It's a big one too. Role of women is huge. The prom.
The prom.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A, should Muslim high schools have a prom?
Oh, wow.
B, if your children are regular high school, can they go to a prom? C, see if they can go to the prom. Should mom and dad come with? Or just mom or just dad? The prom. Enormous. But of course it goes back to male-female. And where does it go back to as well? What other huge issue does this go back to? If you worry, if you lie awake about the prom, apart from what dress to wear, you know, I'm jealous. I never had a prom. We don't have proms. So. It seems so much fun. You know, when you hear it, it seems great fun. But, you know, what do you think? What else, this prom thing? What does
it... dating. Who are the dating?
Huh?
Who they go with?
Dating! So yeah. Scary! Yeah! Because it makes... Yeah, it is scary. Yeah, right. Who of us is still a teenager? So scary. But also, what if they fall in love with someone who's not from Pakistan, not from Egypt, not from Bangladesh? That's the first scary thing. Second scary thing, what if it's not a Muslim? Third scary thing, even worse, what if it's a Muslim of an interpretation or a sect that's totally not yours?
Yeah.
My gosh, what headache. So, you see? So that is a huge issue. So it's the dating, and what does dating stand for? Something
marriage.
Which is huge. Marriage, but first, more and all, more than that, morals.
Yeah.
Morality.
Not getting married.
No, morality. Morality.
Living together.
Oh, yeah. Living together.
I just tried to say it.
My goodness.
Yeah. Right. Even kissing?
That's...
Anybody else who wants to curse in public here?
Kissing, living together and married. Anything else?
Homosexuality.
Oh, homosexuality, that is really on the edge. That's over the edge, yeah. That is a huge issue, yeah.
But you know, everything that we consider normal, dating, kissing, holding hands, standing on the porch after 10 o'clock at night, you know, all these things that are they normal for you guys? You are, have you seen teenagers? Are they normal for you? Yeah, or not?
Isn't
it being Oh, yeah. Your parents
are.
So,
you know that, not normal. I suddenly realized. Sorry.
Anyway, but you see, all these things, that is the big issue. Now, I'll first answer the two people who raised their hand, and then we're going on about the exciting topic of morality.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask, how can we tell what kind of a mosque it is? Like, what are there labels?
Well, you have, when you have a mosque like the one, the big one in Chicago, the Marian Mosque, the St. Mary Mosque, then you know you're close to African American Muslims. You know, the Marian Mosque is Nation of Islam. You know, because that's from the time when they still were mixing, and Maryam is in the Quran. I don't think anywhere in the world you find a mosque called Maryam. Yeah. So, but for the rest?
So they're just called a mosque?
No, they have names, but most of the names are in Arabic. You can see maybe the language, if it has an Iranian name or Turkish name.
How do Muslims know which mosque to go to if they're in a foreign town?
You smell it. You know it. You go in and you know, like I smell a Calvinist church and I'm out of the door right away. So, sorry, of those of you who are Presbyterian. Yeah. It's Dutch Calvinism I'm talking about. But you know, the thing is, you see the many small things. Like we know the liturgy, we know words people use, we know the tone of preaching, the style of preaching. We also see dress. How are people dressed?
So they know that, they see that.
Oh, you see it right away. And then it's ethnic too. You know, you go to a Pakistani mosque, a Bangladeshi mosque, so you know, and then, like, we know difference between people, don't we? I mean, you hear people talk, you know, they don't themselves, and you...
I thought maybe in America it would mix, since...
Yeah, well, that is, of course, what the brothers want. They want it all to mix and all to be one nice mosque with a beautiful Arabic title, and an imam flown in, someone from an Arabic country. That's what they want. But it doesn't work. Yeah. But that's their goal, of course. Yeah. But they're very savvy with technology. And I'll come back to that too. They have the biggest websites. And behind those websites, they have direct links to Egypt. You know, you ask a question on that website, and it goes straight to Egypt, and you get the answer back. Mm-hmm. So you see, that is, they're very technological savvy. And these people, you know, the African Americans, they couldn't get less. They don't have that yet. They have some journals, and that's how they discuss things. Like it's, and they are not hyper. They're not these hyper Muslims. You know, you probably know what I talk about, Jody. The difference between African American Muslims and many Muslims from the, depending on where they're from and how far they are Americanized. If you're a hyper Muslim, you want the correct answer. You see? Now, what the correct answer is, nobody knows. But for example, there are lots of questions also about medical issues. Is heart transplant allowed? Depends on who you ask. Some say yes, some say no. Go figure. You know? And then you have to decide which one you want to follow. If you need a new heart, you follow the one who says yes. but that's enough. And you're not in sin because you have both answers. So you can follow both. And so... So that's a little bit, you know, how you also, how strict. Who has ever been in a mosque or in an Islamic center? And were you in a center where the toilets, we go to the women's toilet. Who has ever been in a women's toilet? Sorry, go to the women's toilet next time. And then look, you know how in America you have a little bit of a gaping pee? You know, an opening in the doors, which of course offended me also terribly, being from Europe. We had closed doors. So it's open. Yeah. You go to one of these very correct mosques, they will seal it. Oh. They will put something in it. And that's how you know you're in a very correct mosque. Mm-hmm. You know, because imagine that one woman sees the other move in there. That goes back again to, where are they? The morals. The morals. Okay, Deanne.
I just wondered if you would say anything about the population of African refugee Muslims and where they fit into this array.
Well, they would be here. They would be here.
Right.
They have their own, again, Somali, you mean the
right,
Muslim.
But they're not Arabic. So
no, they're not Arabic.
They're here.
Like, remember Mohammed Atta? Everybody knows what I'm talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you know the mosque he went to in Berlin, you know, or in Hamburg, not in Berlin. You know where he, you know that there were four mosques in that one building? Who knows about that? Well, there were four mosques in that one building. One was a hyper-Muslim mosque from Saudis. One was a Turkish mosque. One was a mystical mosque, a mosque of Sufis. And one was a mosque of, I forgot which one, some African country. And you know where the mosque was, don't you? Yeah, in Hamburg. You know which area of Hamburg? Red Light District.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Because that's where they could afford. They could afford, because Hamburg is expensive, so that's where they could afford property. And of course, it helped towards the cause. Think about it. You come out of the mosque and you care about morals. Oh my gosh. Think about what you saw, and you see, again, the end of the world is near if you step out of a mosque in a red light district in Hamburg, right? You're sure. So you see, that is, they all had their own mosque. They were not sitting together in the mosque. And so it's also a matter of language. You know, they don't all speak the same language. In many mosques, they have a language in Bangladeshi or in Pakistani or in Turkish, they have the sermon, otherwise nobody could understand it. So you see that they cannot sit together almost. Okay, now, other questions, yeah?
Are mosques normally built so that when you pray in it, you're facing Mecca?
Yeah, always. You always have to face Mecca.
Because I went to this mosque in Seattle, and they didn't face towards Mecca when they prayed.
Ooh.
I don't know why.
What sect was that?
Geographically challenged.
No, you always, according to the Islamic rules, you must face Mecca. You must, and of course everybody knows where that comes from, don't you? Where does the facing Mecca come from? Where did the idea to face Mecca come from? Where were they facing first? Jerusalem, right. They were first facing Jerusalem, and then again, remember to draw the line in the sand to make the difference between us and them, so the difference between the Jews and the Muslims, they started to face Mecca, and no longer Jerusalem. So that it, just from the way people prayed, it would be very clear who was Muslim and who was not. You see? And now it's a rule. Okay, now let's just go to the moral. Which goes back, you know, to marriage and finding a partner, which is huge. And because if you look, if you want to know, you know, what is the curriculum in school in many Muslim countries, it's of course the same curriculum as we have, you know, math and language and science and. And then there is religion and reading the Quran, learning the tradition. But what always has a huge part on the curriculum is morality. Morality. And that is from the youngest age, from 4 years up, children learn how to behave as a Muslim, how to dress as a Muslim, what to play with. You know, you have these handbooks for teaching. You learn that boys cannot play with dolls. And girls cannot play with trucks. And it's very, so you see already a strict division in gender that is being, you know, encouraged. And then you as you grow up, you learn all the moral, the ethics and codes of how you have to behave as a Muslim. And as I say, no holding hands in public. Has any of you ever been in a Muslim country? Have you seen anybody holding hands in public who was local? You see, of course, dumb students, tourists do it. Tourists do it, and then, you know, that people think that this is the dumbest thing on earth who live there. But local people will never hold hands. Have you ever seen anybody kissing in public? No, you couldn't. You can't. Actually, if you kiss in public in Indonesia, there's a law in the making that will cost you $30,000. Kissing in public. Yes. Fined. You're being fined. So, yeah. So you see, there's a certain ethical code that a Muslim learns, that Muslim children learn from very young. And of course, the more Americanized Muslims become, the more they can't care less about their code. Right? And that's very dangerous, because what does it all lead to? If you don't know your moral code, if you ignore your moral code, what does it lead to? Apostasy? Also, yeah. But there's something much worse than apostasy.
Breakup of the family?
Huh?
Family breakup?
Yeah. Something much worse than family breakup. Mm.
Honor.
Honored.
Pregnancy.
I don't know.
I will save you. Fornication or adultery, depending on if you're married or not. There is a word for that, zina. Fornication or adultery, zina. If that starts to happen in society, if you read Muslim writings, if you talk to Muslims, whether it's in Egypt or in Indonesia, the worst that can happen to society is that everybody starts to date and sleep around as they wish. That is the end of your society, the end of your religion, and the end of everything. And as I told you yesterday, the biggest sin for a Muslim is to let Islam disappear, to let Islam, you know, become something else. That is a huge sin. You cannot do that. So that is why all these fatwas are about the prom. You see? Because in the prom, all these ethical and moral rules come together in that one event. You see? And it's huge. It's huge. And it sounds so silly to us, because you said divorce. Divorce is allowed in Islam. It is, according to a tradition of the Prophet, it is frowned upon. The Prophet once said that God does not like divorce, but a lot of people don't care less about that, because in the Quran it says you can divorce. And in the old times you could divorce by just saying, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. And then the woman was divorced. So the man can divorce. That is not it. You see? Having children before you're married, then you're being killed in many Muslim societies. In many societies, not everywhere. In Indonesia, for example, it doesn't happen. Many societies that
just the woman
eliminate. And yes, thank you for saying it. Just a woman. Just a woman. Yeah. So if you are, yesterday someone said, what about if you're raped and what happens a lot in many countries? I mean, that's not just Muslim. That's not Muslim. It's human, right? That children are raped by family members. Mm-hmm. If you become pregnant,
they'll kill them.
They'll kill you. Or they remove you somehow. If you're lucky, they remove you and you disappear in the crowd in a big city with another, with a distant family member or something. But it's something that cannot happen. But you see, for Muslims in the United States of America, keeping the code of honor, keeping the rules as they should be followed is very important. And that's one of the big issues that all these organizations like ISNA and the Muslim Society, the Student Association, fight for. Because they feel that the first battle line is not the Quran. Because, as I told you yesterday, even a secular Muslim will respect the Quran. They will not, you know, say, I don't, they maybe not believe every word in the Quran, maybe they have their own interpretations, but they will not say so out loud, and they will respect the Quran. Secular Muslims also respect the Prophet Muhammad. That's why with the cartoon affair, so many secular Muslims were really mad. They respect, they say, whatever you think of Islam, whatever you think of the Prophet Muhammad, he was a very upright, ethical human being. He brought this message that liberated many people, and that is true, you know, that this society, the Bedouin society where he was born in and worked in, that was a very close society, close-minded, and it was very much broken open by the message of Islam, whatever we think of that message now. It was a huge step forward in those days. So it's not all, that they will never disrespect, but what they do disrespect is the morals. And then you have indeed now Muslim young women who are getting their degrees and have a boyfriend, and he might not be Muslim, and they might even stay overnight. And that is the worst that can happen to the society. You see, do you understand? Can you follow me? There's the first border. There's the first battle line. And then after you have won that battleground, you have all kinds of other things. Do we still have time? Shall I finish in 3 minutes?
3 minutes.
What are the other things? Investing, banking, medical care, just what kind of work can you do? So that's once you have won the people over to follow your moral code. And then, of course, a lot of people like progressive Muslims say it's actually the Middle Eastern moral code. It's not the moral code like we have in our country or like we have in Indonesia, for example. After that, you have huge questions about, can a Muslim save money in a bank because that gives interest and that's forbidden according to Islam? Mm-hmm. Can a Muslim invest in the stock market because what if it is invested in assets or in companies that do things that are forbidden according to Islam? So then a whole array of very detailed issues unfolds. But you have to get the people in the right morality first. And that's why you have all these fatwas about morality and about what to do and how to do it, if you can do it. And that's, of course, the best way to keep people straight